Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in Military History. I am Boris Scarpa. And with us today is Tyler Fox, who is the historian of the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment Association. And he has previously written a book about the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment, which was titled The Fine Sense of Honor, at war with the men of the 504th Parachute Infantry from Sicily to the fall of Germany. And now he has, and he has written extensively on other military history topics as well, but now he has given us a new book, which has just recently come out in December last year, Battle Surgeons, Care Under Fire in the 504th Parachute Infantry. I'm pleased to have you with us today, Tyler.
Oh, thanks for having me. You know, before we get started, I just want to say, I recognize what a investment it is and time to put these things together and do the background research and everything. So I just want to thank you for your time and for giving authors like myself this platform.
You're really welcome here, Tyler. And, you know, I always say that here at the New Books Network, we are a bit like a tiny Jewish village of Anatevka. We have tradition. And our first question is always a traditional one, and I'd like to ask you, for the sake of our audience who have not read the book, and they don't necessarily have access to the website where they can see details about the book, and so I'd like to ask, can you tell us a little bit about your book, Battle Surgeons, Care Under Fire in the 504th Parachute Infantry? Can you tell us a bit more about this book and what it is about, although it's a bit obvious from the title, and what does it bring to the table?
Yeah, so the basics up front, you know, it's about a handful of battalion surgeons in the 504th, and these were the surgeons that were closest to the forward line of troops. You know, they jumped with the infantry battalions, and they were after the company aid man. You know, your medic, they were the first stopover. They were the first real medical intervention that you would see. And so, you know, it follows both them personally, and it also follows them as an organization and how they evolved throughout the war and how they learned, which I know we'll get into a little bit later. You know, and the book was really born out of my own lack of understanding in this topic specifically. You know, I had been researching the regiment for quite a long time, and I realized, you know, I didn't know much about a lot of the surgeons that served in the regiment, and there was quite a few of them. And the other thing was that, you know, what kind of coincided with that was obviously the Russo-Ukrainian war, which brought about, you know, the lack of logistics and how important that is, you know, especially on the Russian side. And so, you know, as the U.S. Army today starts to transition to large-scale combat operations, there's a lot of good stuff in here that I think is applicable or provides context for things today. You know, and just to hit a couple of those points, you know, the first one is the importance of training and your processes and getting full scale reversals to know where your gaps in the organization are. And the other thing that it's important that kind of follows the subplot of this book, which is the division medical service and how that kind of interaction was, is just adaptation and how they adapted to their shortcomings and were able to morph into this, you know, self-contained medical apparatus that could operate, you know, inside of an airhead. I think those points are something really relevant, and there's a lot of discussion, I think, in the Army today about how that's going to look for the future. So back to you, Boris.
So I'd like to, you know, as I mentioned, we have a bit of a unique audience here at the New Books Network. We have people who, you know, by nature, a lot of the people who read a lot are also themselves writers or considering becoming writers. And so I'd like to go back a little bit, and maybe you can tell us a bit more about your, something which you mentioned in passing in your answer, about your writing journey, about your, you know, some of the obstacles which you might have had to overcome when you were working on this book on battle surgeons, and how you've obviously overcome the obstacles you've written in the book, and so and you can tell us about that.
I'm an unassuming writer, I think, if somebody would have known me, say, in high school. You know, I was an okay student. I didn't, you know, spelling was also always a problem for me. You know, I hated those weekly spelling tests. You know, so this was something that was born out subsequent to my interest in history. You know, I was gathering all this information, and I wanted a way to, you know, share some of it and share some of these stories that I was collecting early in my research. And, you know, I think to specifically address, you know, one of the things you brought up is, you know, in terms of the obstacles, I think early on I had a desire to kind of overwhelm the reader with too much in one sentence, you know, introduce too many concepts or too many things. And it's especially difficult, you know, in military history where you have things that are in constant interaction with one another, or that are happening, you know, concurrently, you know, events that are happening concurrently or events that underpin one another, where you, you know, you can't have one event without the other event. And so that was, so I would say the structure, you know, figuring out how to structure writing was the biggest challenge for me. And some of that's also just clarity, you know. And this was evident in a lot of my earlier drafts. You know, some of these chapters I rewrote, you know, three or four times. And overcoming them, you know, I started reading the habits of some famous American writers. The Paris Review has the Art of Fiction series, which I enjoyed quite a lot. So that helped. And then also just reading a lot, mostly fiction. I would have been loath to pick up a fiction book, you know, in my younger days, but within the last few years, I've developed a great love for fiction, especially historical fiction. And that definitely helped my writing in nonfiction, because it helped introduce different techniques that I could use, or different ways of presenting materials. And you know, the last thing is, you know, there's no substitute for sitting your butt in the chair and just doing it, you know, and doing it a lot and doing it over again and getting repetitions, you know. So, you know, those are the big things that I think helped me write in the way that I do now, you know.
So I'd just like to ask you something, which, you know, a question which came to me is that while I was listening to your answer is you don't have a medical background, do you? Was this a bit an obstacle for you that you know neither of us are doctors?
Mm-hmm.
Was it difficult for you to understand some of the concepts, to research the work of surgeons?
A little bit. So I had to spend a little bit of time in a medical dictionary, you know. So I got one for this project. I was also aided greatly. There was a surgeon, an active duty surgeon in the Army, who was gracious enough to allow me to send him some excerpts from the draft and give me a little bit of feedback and kind of help with some of the nuance issues. One thing he specifically helped me with was plasma and whole blood, like the interplay between those two things. And so that was a good help. And then one of the daughters of a veteran of the 504th is also a medical doctor, and so I pinged a couple of questions off of her. So those were three things that helped greatly. And there was a specific document that a report of one of the surgeons of the 307th Airborne Medical Company, which was the division level medical company. They had a report of their surgeries from Holland that also aided in how some of those operations unfolded, and I relied on that document, you know, pretty heavily.
Okay, and just to loop around to something which you said you did a lot of, you know, I was struck when I was reading your book that some of it reads just as if it were a work of fiction, where you go into the actions, into the thoughts of individual persons, of individual doctors and other people. I'd like to ask, because this is a fairly unusual choice for a narrative of this kind, because I've hosted persons before on this show. We've had guests who were historians of this unit or another, and I'd like to say that the form which you chose is a bit unusual for the subject, and I'd like to ask, why did you choose to, mm-hmm. you know, to write almost in this novel-like way?
So, you know, this is kind of an esoteric topic, right? It's got and on its surface has a very narrow audience, you know, medical doctors in a parachute regiment in World War II. You know, so I think presenting it in the way that I did gave me an opportunity to take an esoteric topic and give it a larger audience where the readership could be broader. You know, and I felt the story deserved it, because, you know, the jury's out on how well I did with this book, but even if I were successful,
I do think that you've done really well. You've made something which, you know, a lot of the times these units' histories are very dry to read. I've had to read a few of them over my own education and also for the show. And then I just want to say that to really commend you for having written something which is really accessible.
Oh, well, thank you for that compliment. You know, and it was also, you know, it was also the only way that I could capture and convey who these men actually were, is to engage with them on a personal, you know, more personal level. And you know, it's difficult. Like, the why I say, you know, the jury's out on how well I did is it's you know, it's difficult to capture how visceral and the memories and events were to these guys and their participation in these events, if that makes sense. You know, so it was really the only way that I could try to communicate what they went through and how it affected them.
And, you know, I'd like to ask you about something which is really a lot of on my mind as part of my own research, and it connects also to some of the events which we've seen in the news, as you mentioned, with Russia and Ukraine. you discussed the 82nd Airborne Division's operations in Sicily. They were disastrous in many ways. They were disastrous in terms of the combat operations. They were disastrous in terms of the medical support. And so I'd like to ask, just for the sake of our listeners, how does the U.S. Army medical establishment learn from these failures? How does they try and solve these problems going forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, so to give a little background, General McNair, who was the commanding general of Army Ground Forces, today that would be kind of the equivalent of U.S. Army Forces Command, roughly. And he limited the airborne division in equipment and vehicles and personnel. He put caps on all those things in the early formation of these divisions. And so, you know, they had defects or deficits would probably be a better term for it. They had deficits in, you know, artillery and quartermaster units. And when I say deficits, I specifically am referring to transportation for those things. And this also included the medical aspect. And so the operations in Sicily kind of revealed a inability to move fast, right? Some of their artillery battalions at this time were largely relying on manpower to move their 75-pack howitzer guns. So they consistently needed support from higher commands. And so and this was true from H hour, whenever the parachutes of the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment, you know, opened up over Sicily. When they jumped over Sicily, they were wholly reliant on the 1st Infantry Division, which was coming over the shore for all their servicing, which means all of their supply and all of their casualty evacuation. And this was because, you know, there wasn't enough planes to deploy the entire division as a division. And the 82nd Airborne Division was designed to be employed as a division. And so its piecemeal committal kind of handicapped it. And then the outcome of one of the outcomes of that, kind of as I was alluding to earlier, was they had a deficit in transportation. And so Sicily, and specifically the medical establishment, you know, for the airborne division, it set them off on a massive motorization growth that would, you know, pretty much take until the next year to be fully realized. And specific to medical operations, giving them these jeeps, you know, the classic Willys jeeps were pretty much infused at every level in the medical aspect of the division. You know, one of the major things it did for the infantry regiment was those jeeps lightened up the burden on battalion aid stations to where they could have casualties that were evacuated somewhat rapidly. And, you know, the battalion aid station was able to be unburdened and be able to move quickly with its unit, you know, with its battalion. And so getting those motors as close to the point of injury as possible, you know, really accomplished that and gave them the kind of celerity that they became known for and what they were originally trying to accomplish. And it's kind of paradoxical because, you know, at their formation, the airborne division was supposed to be this light infantry division that could move quickly. And so they didn't give them these jeeps and these trucks, and it ended up almost having the opposite effect. And they ended up, you know, wrestling with some of that balance. So I think it's really, really interesting to look at all that, especially today as how the Army is trying to transition back, or not trying, is transitioning back to division centric operations. You know, ensuring that the force has the platforms that it needs to deploy a division as it's designed and set it up, you know, set up that division commander for the best success. You know, I think this is something that's extremely relevant today, I would argue.
So just to go on a little bit about force design, for the force design nerds in the audience, can you maybe tell us in what way, you know, the medical service a little bit more, because you've started a little bit about this. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the Air War Division's medical service different from that of an armor division or an infantry division at the time?
Oh yeah, it was entirely different, and the Airborne Division, like I mentioned the cast earlier, was not ambitious. So even a standard infantry division, to say nothing of an armored division, you know, they had a medical battalion for their division medical services, and the Airborne Division had a company. So it was smaller in every way, in people and in trucks. And to give an example, you know, a standard division had two clearing platoons and full collecting companies. And those two clearing platoons would have been, you know, where, you know, the center of the doctors for the division, and where they would be doing, you know, prepping patients to be evacuated to field hospitals. And it was kind of the singular point of evacuation for the division. It was the center of the nerve system, so to speak, or the center of a web. You know, they would be sitting in the center and getting fed by the regimental and battalion aid stations. And, you know, to plug one of my favorite books, Brave Men by Ernie Pyle, probably has the best description of how a standard infantry division's medical service worked. And so they had two clearing platoons, which allowed them to have one on and one off, and they could leapfrog them forward. And the Airborne Division didn't have that ability, because they only had a company, and they had three platoons in the company and three regiments to evacuate from. So one of those, you know, would have had to act, one platoon would have had to act as the clearing station for the entire division. And it's interesting, whenever you look at how the British Airborne Divisions approached the problem, it was entirely different. You know, whereas, you know, they had fully resourced, you know, surgical teams that were organic to the Airborne Division, because they recognized that they might have to sit on casualties for an extended period of time in an airborne operation. And I know we'll probably get into more about that when we talk about Operation Market Garden, but you know, they went between the British and the US, they kind of went two different directions. And there's another book, I think it's called On Wings of Healing. There's a book about the British Airborne Division's medical services, and I would recommend that book for somebody interested in looking deeper into the topic.
Now, there was one thing which really shocked me. It actually shocked me when I was reading the book, because, you know, when I read, and it's not my specialty, I'm not a big expert, I'm really a layman on this particular topic, but whenever I hear about, you know, the United States military in World War II, we always hear about these amazing logistics, and, you know, we hear about the ice cream ships, and all of this, yes, and I've read in your book, and there's a discussion of the shortages of rations in the Italian campaign. I'm just going to quote a bit for the audience from your book, if you permit. In other words, they talk about the calorie deficit of 700 to 1200 calories, which the men experienced each day, and said, you say, in other words, men burned just shy of 17 pounds of themselves. It affected every aspect of their health, including the time it took for wounds to heal. I'd like to ask, in terms of the research which you've done, in terms of what you learned when you were working on the book, how did these problems emerge? Because was there some scientific misunderstanding in terms of how much food was needed? Or was there a logistical failure? What happened?
Yeah, so, and you're correct. You know, the supply operations of the Allied forces, and specifically the U.S. forces, was just, it's mind-boggling, right? The scale and intricacy and detail of those things. And what I wrote is actually not an indictment of that, by and large. You know, it was great. And to your specific question, though, it was just a reality of the terrain where the regiment was specifically. You know, you can't organize away a mountain range. You know, you can't supplant it with crates of supplies. You can't supplant that problem that way. And so it was really, like I said, just based on the specific area that they were. And they were sent to that area because, you know, the parachute regiments could exist like that they were light enough in equipment that they could exist up there in an area where, you know, it was virtually devoid of roads. And so what they were having to do to resupply themselves was go around and they were paying Italian farmers for mules to use to take over the trails. And, you know, there's only so many mules, and the regiment was deployed over a wide, very wide area, as I kind of detail in the book. And so some of it was just being a victim of prioritization. You know, they needed, you know, ammunition, small arms, like machine gun ammunition and mortar ammunition were number one, followed by food. And so, you know, that was just the reality of it. And like I said, it's not an indictment of those logistical assets that the Fifth Army brought to bear. And I'll plug another really great book that I enjoy on that subject. It's called War of Supply, a somewhat recent book, I think within the last couple of years, that was published by University of Kentucky Press. You know, it really details a lot of the enterprise that the Fifth Army had.
When you talk about operations, you know, in 1944, and we're really in the end stage of the war here, but at this point, you know, there's no doubt how this is ending. But you still talk about how there are certain issues, and again, we're coming back to force design. You talk about some inadequacies in the divisions, organizations, the table of organization, which is... And for listeners who are not, you might not know, a table of organization is a specific military document which governs, which controls how many soldiers and what equipment there's supposed to be in the unit. And you talk about some of the inadequacies of the division's table of organization, and you talk about, you know, so how these still are not completely solved. There are still some deficiencies in terms of how this affected the ability to collect casualties. And can you maybe cover a bit of some of these, how the 82nd Division particularly tried to work with these shortcomings, how they tried to have fixes for them?
Yeah, so the two things there was, you know, and I'll take each of them in turn, was where to hold casualties when they couldn't evacuate them, and two was their shortcomings that they retained in personnel. So by this time, you know, they still had a medical company for Division Medical Services, but, you know, between 1943 and 1944, a fourth regiment was added. So it went from a 3-regiment division to a 4-regiment division. And still, while they were authorized a little bit of overstrength in the numbers for medical personnel, they were still not at the level that they needed to be. And so how they offset those was just how kind of the process and how they did things and how they employed the limited personnel that they had to make sure that it was most efficient. You know, by this time the motorization had been completed. You know, they were kind of at the pinnacle of the Jeeps that they needed and everything. But what they were still short of was at the time they assaulted into Holland was where they were going to put casualties. Right? They didn't have that large clearing station, and so and what I think is one of the most interesting parts of this story was the 50th Field Hospital was kind of augmented the 18th Airborne Corps. So what I mean by that is there was the 50th Field Hospital started as just your standard, you know, everyday Army Field Hospital. And it was split into a field hospital was split into three kind of platoons or detachments. And, you know, what they did is in August 1944, the commander of the 50th Field Hospital was basically told, you know, we're splitting your hospital up and we're not going to tell you where they're going. And so one of his platoons, unbeknownst to him, like I said, was, you know, went to the 101st Airborne Division and the other went to the 82nd Airborne Division. And that platoon that went with the 82nd Airborne Division, they kind of shucked all their heavy equipment. They couldn't be, you know, loaded in a glider. And they were landed in Holland on D+1 on September 18th to operate alongside the surgeons of the 307th Airborne Medical Company. And what that did was that gave them the kind of the holding capacity and the ward space, for lack of a better term, to hold casualties that couldn't be evacuated until the ground lines of communications were established and became unclogged. You know, it's kind of well known in Operation Market Garden that they went up, you know, a single road. And so that road can only handle so much. And so even though that line of communication, that road, you know, somewhat was established, there were times they couldn't get casualties out because there wasn't enough space on the road. And so, you know, those were the real keys that made this work. You know, they only had 34 fatalities out of, you know, almost, if I remember correctly, almost 1,400 battle casualties that they had in a month. You know, and by October 16th, 1944, the surgical teams had conducted almost 1,000 surgical operations. And so having only 34 deaths, I think, you know, as they wrote in their own report, compares favorably to that of any other division. And this was by a medical company and not a medical battalion, although obviously they were augmented by this field hospital detachment. And I think, like I said, that's just these guys in the 50th Field Hospital, you know, they didn't volunteer for this. They weren't trained for airborne operations. You know, they were just told to go to this airport and they were sealed off and the next thing they know, they landed in Holland. And if memory serves correct, when I went to the National Archives to look at those their records, you know, the commander of the 50th Field Hospital, which was a full colonel, he didn't even know that his hospital platoons had landed in Holland until I want to say a week, maybe two weeks after September 17th and September, the days of September 17th and September 18th, which I think is quite interesting.
So I'd just like to, you know, drive our show towards its conclusion a bit. And so, as I've mentioned, we are creatures of tradition here. You know, so we've started with a tradition and a question, and I'd like to also wrap up with a question, a traditional question. Can you tell us about your own reader's journey, about books which you are also maybe reading right now, something which you would like to suggest to recommend to us?
Boy, hardest question that you've asked me. What I'm reading right now, my kind of standard, if you will, is I like to read a nonfiction book, like a novel, and concurrent with I like to read a fiction book concurrent with a nonfiction book, usually kind of around about the same subject. So there's some interplay there. So right now, what I'm doing is I'm working my way through John McManus's U.S. Army in the Pacific trilogy, and the current novel I'm reading concurrent is From Here to Eternity by James Jones. And I know I've mentioned a couple other books throughout the interview that I especially enjoy. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Those Devils in Baggy Pants by Ross Carter, a veteran of the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment. It's probably my all-time favorite book. I think that the best book that I read last year was a new book, The Wandering Army. I think that was published by Oxford University Press. Trying to think what else. Looking at my bookcase over there, I really enjoy Herman Wouk's The Winds of War and War and Remembrance. Those are also a couple of my all-time favorites. But yeah, and then about the 82nd Airborne Division, I think one of the probably, and I'll end with this one, the best book I think is probably Ridgway's Paratroopers by Clay Blair.
I wanted to say that books are a bit like Doritos. You cannot write just one book. And so I want to say what I often say to guests here. When, not if, you write your next book, you are once again welcome to return to us here, Tyler.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. This has been fun, and like I said, thanks for having me, and hopefully we'll get to talk again sometime.
Thank you for being with us today, Tyler.
Thank you, Boris.